This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. A lot of us know more about the British royal family than we used to, thanks to The Crown, the Netflix drama series that offers an inside look at Buckingham Palace when a young Queen Elizabeth was adjusting to her new life as monarch. We get to know her husband, Philip, whose life is turned upside down by her ascension, her rebellious sister, Margaret, and her uncle, David, whose abdication from the throne in the 30s shocked the nation and caused a deep rift within the royal family. The second season of The Crown is now available for streaming. Our guest today is the series writer and creator, Peter Morgan. Morgan wrote the screenplay for The Queen, starring Helen Mirren, which earned him a Golden Globe. Morgan's also written award-winning plays and the screenplays for the films Frost Nixon, The Last King of Scotland, and The Other Boleyn Girl. Here's a moment from the first season of The Crown, a few days after Elizabeth Windsor, then 25, has learned her father has died and that she is now queen. Elizabeth is played by Claire Foy. She's with her husband Philip, played by Matt Smith. We hear first from her private secretary, played by Harry Haddon Patton.
Though it would help if we could decide here and now on your name.
My name?
Yes, ma'am. Your regnal name. That is the name you'll take as queen. Your father took George. Obviously his name was Albert. And before he abdicated, your uncle took Edward. Of course, his name was David.
What's wrong with my name?
Nothing.
Well, then, let's not overcomplicate matters unnecessarily. My name is Elizabeth.
And long live Queen Elizabeth.
And the first time Queen Elizabeth hears those words from The Crown, the Netflix series that is created by our guest Peter Morgan. Peter Morgan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
It's remarkable to imagine a 25-year-old woman suddenly inheriting this responsibility. She says a few times in the series that she would have preferred to live a more anonymous life. And I saw a piece where you were quoted as calling her a countryside woman of limited intelligence. Was this taken accurately or in context?
No, it was I've paid for that.
It was in the headline of the story I saw, of course.
Yeah. Just about anything, unfortunately, that I say about this show ends up in the headline somewhere that I don't want it to end up. So I've ended up being quite private about this and about my responsibilities here. But yes, I do think she would have been more comfortable as a countrywoman. I do think she is naturally a modest and naturally a shy, retiring person. I think one can sense that. One can sense when someone is hungry for the limelight and when someone would sooner avoid it. That, of course, is quite different from her sense of duty, and which in itself is such an interesting thing to explore. You don't get a sense that people talk about duty very much anymore. And so, when I started sketching out episodes and thinking about what the show could possibly offer me as a writer or an audience, what was the central dilemma at the heart of this, psychologically, emotionally, for the lead character? It would be who she is as Elizabeth Windsor and who she is as Elizabeth Regina, the Queen, are two very different things, and the push and the pull between those two things, a bit like Russian dolls, one within the other.
Have you ever gotten any feedback from the royal family at all about your work in The Crown?
The royal family's not going to give me any feedback about Prince Philip and infidelity, but other people might. And the royal family, I'm delighted to say that I've only met them on a couple of occasions, and on those occasions I steer well clear of telling them who I am or what I'm responsible for, or if they know it, making sure that we're talking about something else. I'm thrilled to give them the distance to have total deniability, and in the same way I want to have respectful distance from them to be allowed to get on with what I do and to take responsibility for what I do. That's a different matter from where do I get the information from about Prince Philip and his alleged infidelities. And what I can tell you is no one has come forward, therefore there is perfect deniability on behalf of the palace. So then you have to ask, am I making it up? If there's nothing on record, is it irresponsible for me to make it up? And then what you have to do is you have to talk to enough people to get enough information. And all I can do is I can assure you that I'm doing them more favors than harm.
You cast a wide net, you do what you can.
You cast a wide net. I have 10 wonderful researchers that work round the clock, but then even they, you know, they don't have access to those circles. But bit by bit, those doors have now opened to us. And trust me, I'm not writing anything for which I don't feel I could be answerable, if not in a court of law, then in a court of critical judgment.
You know, one of the things that drives this story is the abdication of King Edward VIII from the British throne in 1936. And, you know, this was a case where David Windsor was his name before he was king. And he wanted to marry a woman, an American, Wallis Simpson, who was twice divorced. And this was simply not permitted, in part because the king is the head of the Anglican Church, where, you know, divorce is not accepted. And so he couldn't remain on the throne and marry the woman he loved, so he chose to abdicate, which was a really, you know, I don't think I quite realized until I saw this, you know, what a seismic, shocking, traumatic event this was, at least for the royal family. It kind of like the way Watergate was for us. It was in the 70s, but it was a constitutional crisis that we remember decades later. In the early episodes here, we see the abdicated king, who's known as David, was before he was Edward VIII. He's around, but he's sort of banished. You want to just describe the relationship between him and the rest of the royal family?
Well, let's just stop thinking about them as a royal family for just a second. Sure. And think about them as just a regular family, which I have to frequently do in order to enjoy writing this. You know, I don't want to feel like a historian or a royal biographer. I want to feel like a storyteller. And what we have here is a fantastic family saga. And at the heart of any family saga, there is shame, or there is regret, or there are misdemeanors of the past. And no family is complete without an embarrassing uncle. And he is the ultimate embarrassing uncle. And, what he did betrayed everything. He did the very thing that makes the hereditary principle impossible to defend. I mean, you can argue on behalf of the hereditary principle. You can sort of say, well, you know, it works. And yes, here is this one family. And let's just say they've been chosen by God. And let's just say that they have an exalted place and that they deserve the honor that they have. As soon as one of them says, do you know what, I don't really want this, you are inviting the entire hereditary principle concept to be, you know, shattered. And so here's this shattered individual who's now living in Paris, surrounded by all the memorabilia of the office which he gave up for love. You couldn't make a character like that up. He's a gift to any writer, and I absolutely loved writing him.
The cast is terrific here, and he's played by Alex Jennings. The reason, I guess, that he couldn't marry Wallis Simpson and keep the throne, at least one legal reason, was that the sovereign, the king, is the head of the Anglican Church, but didn't recognize, you couldn't marry someone who was divorced whose previous spouse was still alive. So there was that reason. But from his point of view, you're separating me from the one I love, and it just seemed cruel to him.
Hmm. But divorce is a complete no-no.
You know, Claire Foy is just terrific in this role, and I assume you were involved in the casting. You know, what were you looking for, and what did you see in her? 31-year-old
actress. Well, the casting of Claire Foy, which is now sort of almost impossible to imagine, was, you know, she was overlooked. So this doesn't reflect well on me, but I will tell the story and live in shame. So what would happen is I would be sent a list of people coming to the castings, and I would look down the list, and Wednesday's, as it were, casting session would involve the following five young actresses. And I looked down the list, and I go, well, I know that one, that one, that one. Oh, yeah, they're all rather interesting. I'll come in at 11 to see that one, and I'll come in at 12 because I'm busy and important, and I'm far too busy. And whoever this Claire Foy person is, I'm absolutely not interested. And I overlooked and snubbed Claire on no fewer than five occasions, until there was one time where I simply couldn't avoid it because I was interested in the one before and the one after her. And so I then stayed to see her. And then I was like, well, why hasn't no one showed me? What's the matter with any of you? Why didn't you tell me to look at this one? They said, Pete says she's been there on 4 or 5 occasions. And each time you've studiously avoided her. And I said, but she's fantastic.
Yeah, what did you see? What did you see that captivated you?
Well, but it's not an easy part. I mean, you have to be both... Forgive me when I say it, but you have to be both plain and stunning. You know, she has to have both. And a number of the actors that came in were simply too beautiful, you know, too conventionally beautiful, or too... Their faces did not have the full range, because Elizabeth Windsor is a beautiful, or was, is arguably still a beautiful woman, but not all the time and not from every angle. And... her face lights up, you know, with a smile, and can look quite grumpy, quite like a wet weekend, when not smiling, and be overlookable and quite plain. And you need to believe she has intelligence and understand her intelligence, because the Queen, contrary to what people think, I think, she has an intelligence and a very sharp mimicry and an intolerance of fools. But at the same time, she's not that intellectually curious. And so she has to be both quick and alert, and yet at the same time capable of repose and being quite docile. So it's not easy. And she has to be emotionally stable, and I don't think an actor can act that. I mean, of course they can, but it so helps if they are that. And Claire brought a lot of that into the part and then acted a lot of the stuff that she didn't have to perfection, and I saw it in an instant that she could do it.
Peter Morgan is the writer and creator of the Netflix series The Crown. Well, I want to talk about The Queen, which is the feature film that you did before you did the series The Crown. This was directed by Stephen Frears, and we'll hear a scene here. This is about the moment in 1997 when Princess Diana has been killed in a car accident, and because she is divorced from the royal family, the Queen sees her death as a private matter, with no need for a public appearance or even a statement from her, the Queen. And in fact, she takes her family and Diana's two boys, who are her grandchildren, to the royal estate in Scotland, kind of to just get away while London is mourning. And in this scene we're going to hear, she gets a call from the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, played by Michael Sheen, who is concerned because the public and the press are seeing the royal family as heartless because it's expressed no grief at Diana's passing. So we hear the Queen pick up the phone to speak to the Prime Minister.
Prime Minister.
Good morning, Majesty. Sorry to disturb, but I was just wondering whether you'd seen any of today's papers.
We've managed to look at one or two, yes.
In which case, my next question would be whether you felt some kind of response might be necessary.
No. I believe a few over-eager editors are doing their best to sell newspapers, and it would be a mistake to dance to their tune.
Under normal circumstances, I would agree. But, well, my advisors have been taking the temperature among people on the streets, and, well, the information I'm getting is that the mood is quite delicate.
So, what would you suggest, Prime Minister? Some kind of a statement?
No, ma'am. I believe the moment for statements has passed. I would suggest flying the flag at half-mast above Buckingham Palace. And coming down to London at the earliest opportunity. It would be a great comfort to your people, and would help them with their grief.
Their grief? If you imagine I'm going to drop everything and come down to London before I attend to my grandchildren who've just lost their mother, then you're mistaken. I doubt there is anyone who knows the British people more than I do, Mr. Blair, nor who has greater faith in their wisdom and judgment. And it is my belief that they will any moment reject this mood, which is being stirred up by the press, in favor of a period of restrained grief and sober private mourning. That's the way we do things in this country. quietly, with dignity. It's what the rest of the world has always admired us for.
And that is Helen Mirren as Queen Elizabeth in the film The Queen, which was written by our guest Peter Morgan. You know, it's interesting that in The Crown, we see a very young Elizabeth who is struggling to put duty above her personal interests and feelings so often. And in this episode, you know, many decades later, it would seem the Queen puts her personal feelings about Diana and her failed marriage and her disappointment in Diana above her role and, you know, as a sovereign, kind of embodying the nation's grief. Is it? Make sense?
I think that it was exactly the opposite. I think it was that she was doing exactly what she thinks the principle, the right thing to do was, which had nothing to do with her personal feelings. People interpreted it as a personal vendetta. But actually, there is strict protocol at the time where you have even if you're the mother of the future king, if you're divorced, you're no longer part of the royal family. At that point, you're no longer entitled to, you know, the titles. And as such, when you are second or third or fourth or fifth in line or whatever it is, there are quite clear precedents for what happens. And this is a system which works entirely through precedent. You know, what are the rules for what happens when this happens? And of course, when the rules are in conflict with what the natural emotional intelligence or response to a situation would be, that's when you get into trouble. And that's where the royal family has frequently come, you know, has run into trouble, is when their response appears to be emotionally out of step with the strict systems or rules or, you know, and if I went to my researchers, I'd be able to come back to you with 6 or 10 really interesting examples. I'm sitting in a radio station, I've got no access to that. But where there have been really interesting examples where actually you would want emotionally to respond in one way, but actually it's really clear that in the case of, say, the Prince of Wales, you know, who's heir to the throne, the following rules apply. And she, the Queen, behaved perfectly correctly in that scene that you just heard, even though as a mother-in-law or former mother-in-law, it might appear cold and inappropriate. And that's why the response in the country was so animated. She was only doing what she thought the right thing to do was.
And she is eventually persuaded to come to London and join in a national mourning, give a television.
Yeah, the Queen, by the way, never attends funerals, almost never attends funerals. You know, so no matter how close she is to someone, you will find that the Queen does not attend the funeral.
Why? It's protocol?
It is protocol, and it's like the Crown does not attend a funeral. Again, if you gave me a couple of hours to respond, I'd be able to respond with more information. And you know, because again, you know, I keep refusing to swallow all this information myself, because my responsibility is to be a storyteller. These people interest me only insofar as they are a family and a vehicle with which I can analyze the second half of the 20th century or the dynamics of a family as a long-running saga. Swallowing this royal porn, which is what we all call it, you know, so swallowing the minutiae of apparently completely crackpot protocol and so forth, it's not something I particularly delight in. You know, I have 10 full-time researchers on this show, and they work round the clock, and they have certain areas divided up within them, and some of them are more focused on politicians, and some of them are more focused on royal matters.
You know, I saw The Queen when it was made, I think it was 2006, and then, you know, I've watched The Crown recently, all 20 episodes, and then I watched The Queen again, and it was so much fun to see the same characters that are in the series The Crown now, decades later, much older, drawn by the same writer, you, Peter Morgan. You know, they're different actors in some cases, but we see these same people after they've matured and gone through all this life experience. And I'm sort of figured this is Peter Morgan's vision of these people now, later on. Although you did them in the reverse order. You did the older one, the more recent one first.
That's true.
And I wonder, if you were doing The Queen now, after this deep immersion into the Elizabeth of her 20s and 30s and 40s, do you think you would have done it or written it any differently?
I really don't know. I couldn't tell you. I haven't rewatched The Queen. I don't tend to watch anything, you know, by the time you've reached, you know, Final Cut on something, you're so sick of it. And, you know, by the time you've done promotion and so forth, listening to it just now, I was, the only affection I had was not for my writing, but for the beautiful score by Alexandre Desplat, who I notice has just done The Shape of Water and won the Golden Globe the other night. It was a great pleasure to run into him again. He's a wonderful composer. But I tend not to look back on it, but it's interesting that I wrote the older character, the older versions, and let's see. You know, at the moment I can't bear the idea of continuing to write these characters for much longer, but I'm surprised at how much I'm enjoying storylining seasons 3 and seasons 4 as they're coming up, which would be the, as it were, the middle-aged queen, which, you know, comes in between, of course, the queen that you saw in the movie, played by Helen Mirren, and there's a whole generation, as it were, to be played by another actress, and we've asked Olivia Colman to do that, and happily she said yes. But actually, the cumulative depth of knowing that they, you know, knowing them as having written them as younger and having invested in their marriage and the early years of their marriage, and now as the marriage hits middle age, and as they hit middle age, and as they have midlife crises, and as they, you know, go this way and that way as characters, maybe, and this is one of the joy of writing television and having the time to really, really stay with characters, maybe that will really pay dividends and maybe I'll love it.
But the plan is to do 6 seasons, right? To take them up to the present time?
No, I can't think that far ahead. It makes me want to blow my brains out. I can only think in terms of the seasons 3 and 4, okay, which I'm just starting the writing of them at the moment.
Well, Peter Morgan, it's been fun. We will look forward to more of The Crown. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Pleasure.
Peter Morgan is the writer and creator of the Netflix series The Crown. Its second season is now available for streaming. Two TV shows have surfaced recently that explore futuristic themes in an anthology series format. Netflix launched a new season of its Black Mirror series, while another streaming service, Amazon, just premiered a new series based on the works of science fiction writer Philip K. Dick called Electric Dreams. Our TV critic David Bianculli says both shows are part of a television revival.
Some TV genres are perennials and have been around since the early days of television and probably are never going away. Weekly drama series featuring doctors, for example, and cops. But other TV genres are like locusts and are buried, lying dormant until they suddenly resurface. On primetime TV, the game show was dead for decades until Who Wants to Be a Millionaire brought it back. And quite recently, Netflix's Godless, like HBO's Deadwood years before it, did its best to try and revive the TV Western. But no genre on television in this century has had a bigger and better resurgence than the anthology series. In the early golden age of TV, these shows were performed live, with programs like Kraft Television Theater and Goodyear TV Playhouse presenting great dramas like Rod Serling's Requiem for a Heavyweight and Patty Chayefsky's Marty. Then came filmed anthology shows, often hosted by the program's creators, writer Serling again with The Twilight Zone, and director Alfred Hitchcock with Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Eventually, this genre lost out to the weekly dramatic series, where the same protagonist returned every week in a format that was easier to promote and prolong. But TV lost something in the process. The thrill of uncertainty, where anything can happen and any character can be in real danger and even die, and stories can actually wrap up in relatively quick fashion. But almost out of nowhere, the anthology series is back, and in some cases, literally, bigger than ever. The modern standard issue anthology shows are actually postmodern and basically deal with themes of technology versus humanity. The best of them is Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror, which began in England and now is co-produced by Netflix. Last year, an expanded Black Mirror episode won a pair of Emmys in the TV movie category. This year, with an expanded episode called USS Callister, I expect it may do the same. It's a wonderful story about a character trapped against her will in an alternate computerized reality. The same idea, also explored right now on TV, in a standalone episode of Fox's The X-Files, and in an episode of yet another anthology series, Amazon's Electric Dreams, based on the stories of Philip K. Dick. Dick is the science fiction writer who some 50 years ago wrote the stories that later inspired the movies Blade Runner, Total Recall, and Minority Report. For this new series, which includes Bryan Cranston of Breaking Bad as one of its executive producers and stars, the old stories are adapted very freely, sometimes almost unrecognizably, but usually with impressive results. One of the best adaptations, called Safe and Sound, is based on a 1955 Dick story called Foster Your Dead. The original story was about a high school boy whose family buys the newest model of a bomb shelter, only to have it prove instantly obsolete. In this new TV version, Foster is a girl, and the new technology isn't a bomb shelter. It's a Siri-type artificial intelligence that is implanted into her head when she sticks some high-tech gel in her ear. That's the latest gotta-have consumer item in this version. Or is she just imagining it? Because in this story about paranoia, the voice in Foster's head may just be a voice in Foster's head. Especially when it instructs her to do some crazy-sounding things, like searching for anthills or planning an act of terrorism on her own high school. Annalise Basso plays Foster, Connor Paolo is the voice she hears in her head, and after a while, that voice gets mean.
I need a doctor.
You're not sick.
I'm talking to ants.
No, I told you, their antenna can bounce our... You have taken two psych profiles in your life, do you remember?
One after my dad died, and the other just 2 weeks ago for immigration.
Yes, and just like Justin's, your childhood profile bears no similarity to the new one. That little girl was strong, and she was confident and social. Is that really the way you describe yourself now? They changed you.
I need to talk to someone. I need to see a face so I know this is not happening inside my head.
Grow the f*** up, Foster! I know your dad heard voices. I know he lost his mind and killed himself, but that is not you. This is happening. This is how the world really works, and people are gonna die unless you listen. So are you listening?
Yeah.
At this point in the story, anything could happen, even to her. And that's the beauty of the anthology series. In the past few years, TV has taken this idea and expanded it, coming up with extended narratives lasting 10 episodes or so that end, then return with all new casts and stories. The FX network is the pioneer here. Ryan Murphy has presented 7 very different seasons so far of American Horror Story, and has just followed his superb American crime story entry, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, with a new drama about the murder of Johnny Versace. And Noah Hawley, with 3 dizzyingly different seasons of FX's Fargo, has perfected this new form. It's part series, part miniseries, part anthology show, and it's thrilling. And the best development of all may be that CBS, for its streaming CBS All Access site, has announced plans to present a new version of The Twilight Zone. A version produced by Jordan Peele, who just wowed everyone with the very zone-ish movie thriller Get Out. With news like that, and with the creative success of shows like Black Mirror and Electric Dreams, and the extended dramas like Fargo, there's no question whatsoever. The anthology show is back.
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching. His latest book is The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. In 1957, 3 years after the Supreme Court declared segregated schools unconstitutional, 9 black students were chosen by the NAACP to try and integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. Enrolling was one thing, attending was something else.
We've just got a report here on this end that the students are in. They're
The students were met by an angry white mob, and it took the presence of federal troops to get them into classes for more than one day. Our guest today is Melba Patillo Beals, one of those students who came to be known as the Little Rock Nine. She wrote in her book, Warriors Don't Cry, that every day she got up, polished her saddle shoes, and went off to war. After that school year, Patillo Beals went to California, where she got an education and pursued careers as a TV journalist, magazine writer, communications executive, and university professor. But as you'll hear, her year at Central High left emotional scars that were long-lasting. Melba Patillo Beals has a doctorate in international multicultural education and was awarded a Congressional Gold Medal in 1999. She's written a new memoir called I Will Not Fear, and a book about her childhood for younger readers. It's called March Forward, Girl. Well, Dr. Melba Patillo Beals, welcome to Fresh Air. It's good to have you. You write that you grew up with a lot of fear. What were you afraid of?
Every single time, day turned to night, I was frightened that the Klan would ride. From a very early age, I watched the parents around me pull the shades, quiet us all down, to make our house look as though we were being very good Negroes. Pull us in, pull anything from the outside that looked as though we were engaged in any activity they would object to. I watched this routine go on for all of my early life.
Let's move to 1957, when the Supreme Court had ruled that the separate but equal doctrine for public education did not hold, that integration was called for, and this was a rocky start to the integration of Central High School. You want to just tell us about the first day when you and your mom went thinking you were going to get into the high school.
When we walked up behind this big crowd, we realized, ah-ha-ha-ha, we have really done something that we shouldn't have done. We anticipated that the people were all on tippy-toe looking across the street for what we didn't know. Let's us go look. So we walked up behind this crowd that was probably six people deep. There were thousands of people there. And we tried to go through because we were going to go across the street and go to the school. And right away, these guys started hanging. You know, we got us a nigger right here to hang. Right here. No need of looking across the street to get that one. We got one here. And it went downhill from there. They started chasing us. We started running. We had parked the car at the end of that block. And I thought for sure we wouldn't make it. They got close to my mother, close enough to my mother that they grabbed her jacket off of her. At one point, they made her drop her valise, and she picked it back up because she was dressed to go to school. She was a school teacher. And we get to the car just by, you know, my grandmother said, look, if you're ever in a really tight place, understand that at every moment of your life, God is as close to you as your skin. You have but to pray, and he will show you that he's there and he will help you. So I'd never tested that. And so I'm 15, and I think to myself, aha, it appears to me that this is the time, you know what I'm saying? Because these guys have ropes, and they're directly behind me, and they're chasing, and they're calling me all sorts of names, and they're saying what they're going to do with us before they hang us, right? And so I started to pray. And I prayed out loud as I possibly could, hoping that this would facilitate God's hearing me. And I thought, how's he going to, you know, fix this? Because we couldn't call the police. We knew that. What would the police do? They would help the other people. And so I thought, well, how will we get past this? And it was that this was an unpaved sidewalk, and there were all sorts of bushes and branches and things across the walkway. And whereas we saw these two things, I suppose the gentleman behind us who was so angry with their ropes in the air and their, you know, they didn't. And so they fell, and just for an instant, that gave us one instant to get to the car. We got to the corner, and my mother had earlier said, go, drive, here are the keys, because she'd been teaching me to drive. And I got into the car, and we backed down that hill. I mean, just as she was getting in, this guy caught a hold of the car door. They were banging on the front glass of the car, and I backed down that hill faster than I had ever driven forward. And you turned around. Yeah. It got away.
Wow. So your first attempt, you don't even get in the building. You barely escape with your life from this mob that was there.
Right. And then the second attempt, we do get in.
Right. The second, it was a couple of weeks later, right? And the Little Rock police.
Well, yes, because you had to give the courts time to say, look here to Governor Faubus, you know, we're going to do this. And no matter what you think, we're going to do it. Because he kept erecting troops in front of the school. And he was going through all sorts of machinations to stop it. And so this court order...
Maybe we should just mention here that Governor Orville Faubus had the National Guard troops in front of the high school that day. And you might think they were there to protect the students. In fact, they were there to keep them out, right?
Well, but we had to learn that because Elizabeth Eckford approached these guardsmen thinking, you know, okay, well, they're going to escort us, say this, you know, 150, 200 steps up to the stairs. No. They closed rank to keep her out. And she was the one who got spat upon until you could wring her clothing out as she walked this, you know, block length from where they were in the middle to the corner and were was eventually rescued by the Lorches, who were a couple.
So the second time you go back, some time has passed. There has been a court hearing, and the Little Rock police escort you into the building, but there's still a big mob outside, right?
Huge mob. As we're being let out of this car on the side, I think it's 14th Street side, and I'm hearing this crowd and their sawhorses. I see sawhorses holding them back, and I think, oh, boy. And, you know, if you've never been in a situation like this, you know, how you're going to feel is odd. So I got out of the side of the car, and the police were escorting us up the side steps and everything like that. And the thing is that once you step inside of Central High School, it's so huge. And it was so dark in there, you know. And we were greeted by this sort of middle-aged, dark-haired woman who was quite, I would say, unwelcoming and said she was going to take us to where we needed to go, which at that point was to the office. And so we were marched down this hall of screaming, yelling, spitting young people, young white people who didn't want us there, to the principal's office. And there we gathered, and they were going to assign us classrooms. Now, understand if you've got seven floors of classrooms, but you've only got nine people, and you've got all those hundreds of students, I think you want to put them in close proximity to each other so you could guard them, but no. They said, hey, you want integration? You're going to get integration. And they sent us nine different ways.
So your first two attempts, you and these fellow students to get into Little Rock, into Central High School at Little Rock, actually you didn't even complete full days. You barely escaped with your lives from the mob. And President Eisenhower sent federal troops, the 101st Airborne, to make sure that you were escorted into the classes and kept safe. They got you in, but they couldn't follow you into classrooms. And I want you to tell us what it was like when you actually got into a classroom and the soldiers were outside. How were you treated by the students? How did the teachers respond?
Some of the teachers were, shall we say, okay. Then, or they were cordial. They were civil. Others were not. And they let you know right away what they thought. And here I had to begin thinking about, how can I save my life during this class? Do I need to sit in the back or the front? Shall I sit where I can look at the soldier? Although I could look at my soldier sometimes, he couldn't come through. He might signal me to move over here, do this, do that. But the fact of the matter was that I was, you know, completely open to whatever happened. And many of the classrooms, some of the classes, the teachers were strong, and they said, sit down, don't touch her, don't hit her. Others, they didn't care what happened, you know.
What kinds of things would students do in class?
Light paper and take a match, light a piece of paper and throw it on you. Particularly in study hall, they love that trick. Hit you, throw things at you. A favorite thing was to do something to your back. Smear peanut butter in. One of the most heinous crimes was to smear peanut butter and glumpy stuff onto your seat so that you didn't notice, really. Because when I was walking in class, I was sort of looking around my back. And I'd sit down in it, and what they do is put glass in it.
And when
the whole thing of discovering that you've done that, the whole thing of, you know, if you don't pull your dress down, then it's going to get into your thighs or wherever it gets because it penetrates your clothes. It can penetrate your clothing. However you sit, unless you're wearing some heavy-duty jeans, you're going to be in trouble with that one because they did that one several times.
This became a day-to-day struggle. You say, you write at one point, you got up and you went to war. Other kids go to school. You went to school, but you went to war. How did it affect your life at home?
Well, you know, I didn't feel, I felt unwarm. And my tummy hurt a lot. And my grandmother and mother tried their best. My father by then was gone, and my parents got divorced. And that was a hard thing to go through at the same time. But my grandmother and mother tried the best to bake gingerbread and take us downtown and to do the things that could make me feel like everything's going to be okay, normal. But most of the time at home, I worried. Like, I would just have, like, Friday night free, and then Saturday I'd start to worry again that Sunday's going to come, I'm going to have church, and then I have to go back to that place again. And so my life at home was not as sweet as it had been. Always my mother and grandmother did the best to provide a loving home, that they, as loving as they could possibly provide, you know.
But it followed you home, too, right? I mean, the phone would ring with insults and threats. And
consistently.
And there were two guys parked outside your house all the time?
Two guys parked outside my house who threatened to do bad things. My grandmother was a shooter. Because she'd grown up partially on an Indian reservation, and her relatives, her uncles and their father were Indians, American Indians. She knew she could shoot, and that at 100 yards, do you know what I'm saying? And so she kept a shotgun, Mr. Higginbottom, on her windowsill because people would come. And at one point, they did shoot into the house, as you'll remember, early in the Little Rock incident, and they took away her green vase, her flower vase that was on the TV, shattered it. And so it was fear. What occupied me was fear. I wasn't allowed to be an open teenager, to go where I wanted to go. I could no longer go to the community center to hang. There was no hanging now. Because get it and do understand it. As one of the Little Rock Nine, some of my own people were not quite happy with me because they were losing their jobs. They were losing their salvation contributions at Christmas time.
Why were they losing their jobs? And why were they losing jobs and money?
Well, because they worked for the same white people that my grandmother worked for. My grandmother was a maid, a dollar a day in white ladies' kitchens. And she was careful never, ever to connect herself to me, one of the Little Rock Nine. She just would say, oh, my goodness, that's news. I wonder whose child that is. Because she had a different last name than we did. She never told any of her white employers that that's who she was. And the black people were losing jobs consistently.
Your mom was fired, right?
My mom lost her job. And her story is great because we had a black bishop in North Little Rock who'd been very powerful among the blacks and said to be powerful among whites. And my mother went to him and told him that her job had been taken away. And he told her, prepare to go back to work. Just to simply mention his name. And she did, and he was correct.
Did any white students try and help? Or just extend a hand of
friendship? Yeah. First of all, I want to say something clearly so that everybody doesn't get the wrong impression. There were sane, God-fearing white people in Little Rock, Arkansas, who honestly gave us help. Some of them by giving jobs to the black people who've been fired. By giving money to the black people who've been fired, by giving them jobs like in their yards, mow here, mow there, mow everywhere, go work for Uncle Daddy in Chicago. And so some of the people were very generous in their attempts and in their efforts to help us. And that should really be clear.
You made it through that year, but in the end, you didn't go back to Central next year. What happened?
The governor, Governor Favas, closed all schools to keep us from returning in the school year of 1958. And that was difficult because he closed black schools and those black children called us, they called me, and at church treated us terribly because we'd taken away from them now their Christmas donations, their jobs, their homes, and now their schools. And they were unhappy. Black kids were almost as unhappy as white kids. Not as many of them were, but certainly some of them were. They called us and said, you know, you guys let go.
You know, we don't have time to cover the story that the book tells, but, I mean, you got an education and you were a mom and then adopted two sons and were a journalist and eventually a communications specialist. And you described, you know, the discrimination you experienced in employment and housing. And I just have to ask you, given that you were, you know, you were played a path-breaking role in civil rights in this country, how much progress have we made as a nation towards overcoming this terrible legacy of racism?
I thought by this time, when I'm 76, which if you look back is how many years from 56? I thought that it would be over. I thought that equality would be here, but I was wrong. I was really wrong. But how is life different now? I have a voice. And so we have indeed, my dear, come a very, very long way. You may hit me now on the way out of the studio, but I have a voice. I can report that, and of the policemen who come to take that report, one of them's going to be okay. He's going to say, no, this shouldn't have happened, and he's going to do something about it. And so I'll take that for now. People beyond where I am will have to keep struggling as those who came before me struggle. That's cool. I see progress. It certainly is not happening at the speed I want it to happen, but there is incredible progress that I sit here before this camera, this microphone, that I was a news reporter, that you're interested in interviewing me regarding books which are on that topic, that people with white faces welcomed me here. And so, yeah, we've made some progress. From where I was, baby, don't you ever forget that I rode in the back of the bus near the fussy, gassy engine. I drank from a water fountain marked colored. Don't forget it, and I never, ever forget it. So I've come a long, long way.
Well, Melba Patello-Beals, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
Melba Patello-Beals is one of nine black students who were chosen to integrate Central High School in Little Rock in 1957. Beals has a new memoir called I Will Not Fear and a book about her childhood for younger readers called March Forward Girl.